By World Series time of 1950, this was the year the Philadelphia Whiz Kids dropped four straight, you will remember, Andy was having no more trouble from the sisters. Stamos and Hadley had passed the word. If Andy Dufresne came to either of them, or any of the other screws that formed a part of their coterie and showed so much as a single drop of blood in his underpants, every sister in Shawshank would go to bed that night with a headache. They didn't fight it. As I've pointed out, there was always an 18-year-old car thief, or a firebug, or some guy who'd gotten his kicks handling little children. After the day on the plate shop roof, Andy went his way, and the sisters went theirs. He was working in the library then, under a tough old con named Brooks Hatlin. Hatlin had gotten the job back in the late 20s because he had a college education. Brooksy's degree was in animal husbandry, true enough, but college educations in institutes of lower learning like the Shank are so rare that it's a case of beggars not being able to be choosers. In 1952, Brooksy, who had killed his wife and daughter after losing his streak at poker back when Coolidge was president, was paroled. As usual, the state, in all its wisdom, had let him go long after any chance he might have had to become a useful part of society was gone. He was 68 and arthritic when he tottered out of the main gate in his Polish suit and his French shoes, his parole papers in one hand and a Greyhound bus ticket in the other. He was crying when he left. Shawshank was his world. What lay beyond its walls was as terrible to Brooks as the western seas had been to superstitious 15th-century sailors. In prison, Brooksy had been a person of some importance. He was a librarian, an educated man. If he went to the Kittery Library and asked for a job, they wouldn't even give him a library card. I heard he died in a home for indigent old folks up Freeport way in 1953, and at that he lasted about 6 months longer than I thought he would. Yeah, I guess the state got its own back on Brooksy, all right. They trained him to like it inside the shithouse, and then they threw him out. Andy succeeded to Brooksy's job, and he was librarian for 23 years. He used the same force of will I'd seen him use on Byron Hadley to get what he wanted for the library, and I gradually saw him turn one small room, which still smelled of turpentine because it had been a paint closet until 1922 and had never been properly aired, lined with Reader's Digest, condensed books, and National Geographics, into the best prison library in New England. He did it a step at a time. He put a suggestion box by the door and patiently weeded out such attempts at humor as "More Fook Books, Please," and "Escape in 10 Easy Lesions." He got hold of the things the prisoners seemed serious about. He wrote to the major book clubs in New York and got two of them, the Literary Guild and the Book of the Month Club, to send editions of all their major selections to us at a special cheap rate. He discovered a hunger for information on such small hobbies as soap carving, woodworking, sleight of hand, and card solitaire. He got all the books he could on such subjects, and those two jailhouse staples, Earl Stanley Gardner and Louis L'Amour. Cards never seemed to get enough of the courtroom or the open range. And yes, he did keep a box of fairly spicy paperbacks under the checkout desk, loaning them out carefully and making sure they always got back. Even so, each new acquisition of that type was quickly read to tatters. He began to write to the State Senate in Augusta in 1954. Stamos was warden by then, and he used to pretend Andy was some sort of mascot. He was always in the library, shooting the bull with Andy, and sometimes he'd even throw a paternal arm around Andy's shoulders or give him a goose. He didn't fool anybody. Andy Dufresne was no one's mascot. He told Andy that maybe he'd been a banker on the outside, but that part of his life was receding rapidly into his past, and he'd better get a hold on the facts of prison life. As far as that bunch of jumped-up Republican Rotarians in Augusta was concerned, there were only three viable expenditures of the taxpayers' money in the field of prisons and corrections. Number one was more walls, number two was more bars, and number three was more guards. As far as the State Senate was concerned, Stamos explained, the folks in Thomaston and Shawshank and Pittsfield and South Portland were the scum of the earth. They were there to do hard time, and by God and sonny Jesus, it was hard time they were going to do. And if there were a few weevils in the bread, wasn't that just too fucking bad? Andy smiled his small, composed smile and asked Stamos what would happen to a block of concrete if a drop of water fell on it once every year for 1,000,000 years. Stamos laughed and clapped Andy on the back. "You got 1,000,000 years, old horse, but if you did, I believe you'd do it with that same little grin on your face. You go on and write your letters. I'll even mail them for you if you pay for the stamps." Which Andy did. And he had the last laugh, although Stamos and Handley weren't around to see it. Andy's request for library funds were routinely turned down until 1960, when he received a check for $200. The Senate probably appropriated it in hopes that he would shut up and go away. Vain hope. Andy felt that he had finally gotten one foot in the door, and he simply redoubled his efforts. 2 letters a week instead of one. In 1962, he got $400, and for the rest of the decade, the library received $700 a year, like clockwork. By 1971, that had risen to an even 1,000. Not much, stacked up against what your average small-town library receives, I guess, but $1,000 can buy a lot of recycled Perry Mason stories and Jake Logan westerns. By the time Andy left, you could go into the library, expanded from its original paint locker to 3 rooms, and find just about anything you'd want. And if you couldn't find it, chances were good that Andy could get it for you. Now, you're asking yourself if all this came about just because Andy told Byron Hadley how to save the taxes on his windfall inheritance. The answer is yes and no. You can probably figure out what happened for yourself. Word got around that Shawshank was housing its very own pet financial wizard. In the late spring and the summer of 1950, Andy set up 2 trust funds for guards who wanted to assure a college education for their kids. He advised a couple of others who wanted to take small flyers in common stock, and they did pretty damn well, as things turned out. One of them did so well he was able to take an early retirement 2 years later. And I'll be damned if he didn't advise the warden himself, old Lemon Lips George Dunahy, on how to go about setting up a tax shelter for himself. That was just before Dunahy got the bum's rush, and I believe he must have been dreaming about all the millions his book was going to make him. By April of 1951, Andy was doing the tax returns for half the screws at Shawshank, and by 1952 he was doing almost all of them. He was paid in what may be a prison's most valuable coin, simple goodwill. Later on, after Greg Stamos took over the warden's office, Andy became even more important. But if I tried to tell you the specifics of just how, I'd be guessing. There are some things I know about and others I can only guess at. I know that there were some prisoners who received all sorts of special considerations, radios in their cells, extraordinary visiting privileges, things like that. And there were people on the outside who were paying for them to have those privileges. Such people are known as angels by the prisoners. All at once some fellow would be excused from working in the plate shop on Saturday forenoons, and you'd know that fellow had an angel out there who'd coughed up a chunk of dough to make sure it happened. The way it usually works is that the angel will pay the bribe to some middle-level screw, and the screw will spread the grease both up and down the administrative ladder. Then there was the discount auto repair service that laid Warden Dunahy low. It went underground for a while and then emerged stronger than ever in the late '50s, and some of the contractors that worked at the prison from time to time were paying kickbacks to the top administration officials, I'm pretty sure. And the same was almost certainly true of the companies whose equipment was bought and installed in the laundry and the license plate shop and the stamping mill that was built in 1963. By the late '60s, there was also a booming trade in pills, and the same administrative crowd was involved in turning a buck on that. All of it added up to a pretty good-sized river of illicit income, not like the pile of clandestine bucks that must fly around a really big prison like Attica or San Quentin, but not peanuts either. And money itself becomes a problem after a while. You can't just stuff it into your wallet and then shell out a bunch of crumpled 20s and dog-eared 10s when you want a pool built in your backyard or an addition put on your house. Once you get past a certain point, you have to explain where that money came from. And if your explanations aren't convincing enough, you're apt to wind up wearing a number yourself. So there was a need for Andy's services. They took him out of the laundry and installed him in the library. But if you wanted to look at it another way, they never took him out of the laundry at all. They just set him to work washing dirty money instead of dirty sheets. He funneled it into stocks, bonds, tax-free municipals, you name it. He told me once, about 10 years after that day on the plate shop roof, that his feelings about what he was doing were pretty clear, and that his conscience was relatively untroubled. The rackets would have gone on with him or without him. He had not asked to be sent to Shawshank, he went on. He was an innocent man who had been victimized by colossal bad luck, not a missionary or a do-gooder. Besides, Red, he told me with that same half-grin, what I'm doing in here isn't all that different from what I was doing outside. I'll hand you a pretty cynical axiom. The amount of expert financial help an individual or company needs rises in direct proportion to how many people that person or business is screwing. The people who run this place are stupid, brutal monsters, for the most part. The people who run the straight world are brutal and monstrous, but they happen not to be quite as stupid, because the standard of competence out there is a little higher. Not much, but a little. But the pills, I said. I don't want to tell you your business, but they make me nervous. Reds, uppers, downers, nembutols. Now they've got these things they call phase fours. I won't get anything like that. Never have. No, Andy said. I don't like the pills either. Never have. But I'm not much of a one for cigarettes or booze either, but I don't push the pills. I don't bring them in, and I don't sell them once they are in. Mostly it's the screws who do that. But, I know there's a fine line there. What it comes down to, Red, is some people refuse to get their hands dirty at all. That's called sainthood, and the pigeons land on your shoulders and crap all over your shirt. The other extreme is to take a bath in the dirt and deal any goddamn thing that will turn a dollar. Guns, switchblades, Big H, what the hell? You ever have a con come up to you and offer you a contract? I nodded. It's happened a lot of times over the years. You are, after all, the man who can get it, and they figure if you can get them batteries for their transistor radios or cartons of Luckies or lids of reefer, you can put them in touch with a guy who'll use a knife. Sure you have, Andy agreed, but you don't do it. Because guys like us, Red, we know there's a third choice. An alternative to staying Simon pure or bathing in the filth and the slime. It's the alternative that grown-ups all over the world pick. You balance off your walk through the hog wallow against what it gains you. You choose the lesser of two evils and try to keep your good intentions in front of you. And I guess you judge how well you're doing by how well you sleep at night and what your dreams are like. Good intentions, I said, and laughed. I know all about that, Andy. A fella can toddle right off to hell on that road. Don't you believe it, he said, growing somber. This is hell. Right here in the shank. They sell pills, and I tell them what to do with the money. But I've also got the library, and I know of over 24 guys who have used the books in there to help them pass their high school equivalency tests. Maybe when they get out of here, they'll be able to crawl off the shit heap. When we needed that second room back in 1957, I got it, because they want to keep me happy. I work cheap. That's the trade-off. And you've got your own private quarters. Sure, that's the way I like it. The prison population had risen slowly all through the 50s, and it damn near exploded in the 60s, what with every college-age kid in America wanting to try dope and the perfectly ridiculous penalties for the use of a little reefer. But in all that time, Andy never had a cellmate, except for a big, silent Indian named Normadon. Like all the Indians in the shank, he was called Chief, and Normadon didn't last long. A lot of the other long-timers thought Andy was crazy, but Andy just smiled. He lived alone, and he liked it that way. And as he'd said, they liked to keep him happy. He worked cheap. Prison time is slow time. Sometimes you'd swear it's stop time, but it passes, it passes. George Donaghy departed the scene in a welter of newspaper headlines shouting scandal and nest-feathering. Stamos succeeded him, and for the next 6 years Shawshank was a kind of living hell. During the reign of Greg Stamos, the beds in the infirmary and the cells in the solitary wing were always full. One day in 1958, I looked at myself in a small shaving mirror I kept in my cell and saw a 40-year-old man looking back at me. A kid had come in back in 1938. A kid with a big mop of carroty red hair, half crazy with remorse, thinking about suicide. That kid was gone. The red hair was going gray and starting to recede. There were crow's tracks around the eyes. On that day, I could see an old man inside, waiting his time to come out. It scared me. Nobody wants to grow old in stir. Stamos went early in 1959. There had been several investigative reporters sniffing around, and one of them even did 4 months under an assumed name for a crime made up out of whole cloth. They were getting ready to drag out scandal and nest feathering again, but before they could bring the hammer down on him, Stamos ran. I can understand that, boy, can I ever. If he had been tried and convicted, he could have ended up right in here. If so, he might have lasted all of 5 hours. Byron Hadley had gone 2 years earlier. The sucker had a heart attack and took an early retirement. Andy never got touched by the Stamos affair. In early 1959, a new warden was appointed, and a new assistant warden, and a new chief of guards. For the next 8 months or so, Andy was just another con again. It was during that period that Normandin, the big half-breed Passamaquoddy, shared Andy's cell with him. Then everything just started up again. Normandin was moved out, and Andy was living in solitary splendor again. The names at the top change, but the rackets never do. I talked to Normandin once about Andy. Nice fella, Normandin said. It was hard to make out anything, he said, because he had a hare lip and a cleft palate. All his words came out in a slush. I liked it there. He never made fun. But he didn't want me there, I could tell. Big shrug. I was glad to go, me. Bad draft in that cell, all the time cold. He don't let nobody touch his things. That's okay, nice man, never made fun. But big draft. Rita Hayworth hung in Andy's cell until 1955, if I remember right. Then it was Marilyn Monroe. That picture from the 7-year itch, where she's standing over a subway grating and the warm air is flipping her skirt up. Marilyn lasted until 1960, and she was considerably tattered about the edges when Andy replaced her with Jane Mansfield. Jane was, you should pardon the expression, a bust. After only a year or so, she was replaced with an English actress. Might have been Hazel Court, but I'm not sure. In 1966, that one came down, and Raquel Welch went up for a record-breaking 6-year engagement in Andy's cell. The last poster to hang there was a pretty country rock singer whose name was Linda Ronstadt. I asked him once what the posters meant to him, and he gave me a peculiar, surprised sort of look. Why, they mean the same thing to me as they do to most cons, I guess, he said. Freedom. You look at those pretty women and you feel like you could almost, not quite, but almost, step right through and be beside them. Be free. I guess that's why I always liked Raquel Welch the best. It wasn't just her, it was that beach she was standing on. Looked like she was down in Mexico somewhere, someplace quiet where a man would be able to hear himself think. Did you ever feel that way about a picture, Red? That you could almost step right through it. I said I'd never really thought of it that way. Maybe someday you'll see what I mean, he said. And he was right. Years later, I saw exactly what he meant. And when I did, the first thing I thought of was Normandin, and about how he'd said it was always cold in Andy's cell. A terrible thing happened to Andy in late March or early April of 1963. I have told you that he had something that most of the other prisoners, myself included, seemed to lack. Call it a sense of equanimity, or a feeling of inner peace, maybe even a constant and unwavering faith that some day the long nightmare would end. Whatever you want to call it, Andy Dufresne always seemed to have his act together. There was none of that sullen desperation about him that seems to afflict most lifers after a while. You could never smell hopelessness on him. until that late winter of 63. We had another warden by then, a man named Samuel Norton. The Mathers, Cotton, and Increase would have felt right at home with Sam Norton. So far as I know, no one had ever seen him so much as crack a smile. He had a 30-year pin from the Baptist Advent Church of Elliott. His major innovation as the head of our happy family was to make sure that each incoming prisoner had a New Testament. He had a small plaque on his desk, gold letters inlaid in teak wood, which said, "Christ is my Savior." A sampler on the wall made by his wife read, "His judgment cometh, and that right early." This latter sentiment cut zero ice with most of us. We felt that the judgment had already occurred, and we would be willing to testify with the best of them that the rock would not hide us, nor the dead tree give us shelter. He had a Bible quote for every occasion, did Mr. Sam Norton. And whenever you meet a man like that, my best advice to you would be to grin big and cover up your balls with both hands. There were less infirmary cases than in the days of Greg Stammers, and so far as I know, the moonlight burials ceased altogether, but this is not to say that Norton was not a believer in punishment. Solitary was always well populated. Men lost their teeth not from beatings, but from bread and water diets. It began to be called grain and drain, as in, "I'm on the Sam Norton grain and drain train, boys." The man was the foulest hypocrite that I ever saw in high position. The rackets I told you about earlier continued to flourish, but Sam Norton added his own new wrinkles. And he knew about them all, and because we had gotten to be pretty good friends by that time, he let me in on some of them. When Andy talked about them, an expression of amused, disgusted wonder would come over his face, as if he were telling me about some ugly, predatory species of bug that was, by its very ugliness and greed, somehow more comic than terrible. It was Warden Norton who instituted the Inside Out program. You may have read about it some 16 or 17 years back. It was even written up in Newsweek. In the press, it sounded like a real advance in practical corrections and rehabilitation. There were prisoners out cutting pulpwood, prisoners repairing bridges and causeways, prisoners constructing potato cellars. Norton called it Inside Out, and was invited to explain it to damn near every Rotary and Kiwanis club in New England, especially after he got his picture in Newsweek. The prisoners called it road ganging. So far as I know, none of them were ever invited to express their views to the Kiwanians or the Loyal Order of Moose. Norton was right in there, on every operation, 30-year church pin and all, from cutting pulp to digging storm drains to laying new culverts under state highways. There was Norton, skimming off the top. There were 100 ways to do it, men, materials, you name it. But he had it coming another way as well. The construction businesses in the area were deathly afraid of Norton's inside-out program because prison labor is slave labor, and you can't compete with that. So Sam Norton, he of the testaments and the 30-year church pin, was passed a good many thick envelopes under the table during his 16-year tenure as Shawshank's warden, and when an envelope was passed, he would either overbid the project, not bid at all, or claim that all his inside-outers were committed elsewhere. It has always been something of a wonder to me that Norton was never found in the trunk of a Thunderbird parked off a highway somewhere down in Massachusetts, with his hands tied behind his back and half a dozen bullets in his head. Anyway, as the old Barrel House song says, "My God, how the money rolled in." Norton must have subscribed to the old Puritan notion that the best way to figure out which folks God favors is by checking their bank accounts. Andy Dufresne was his right hand in all of this, his silent partner. The prison library was Andy's hostage to fortune. Norton knew it, and Norton used it. Andy told me that one of Norton's favorite aphorisms was, "One hand washes the other." So Andy gave good advice and made useful suggestions. I can't say for sure that he hand-tooled Norton's inside-out program, but I'm damn sure he processed the money for the Jesus-shouting son of a whore. He gave good advice, made useful suggestions. The money got spread around, and son of a bitch, the library would get a new set of automotive repair manuals, a fresh set of Grolia encyclopedias, books on how to prepare for the scholastic achievement tests, and, of course, more Earl Stanley Gardners and more Louis L'Amours. And I'm convinced that what happened, happened because Norton just didn't want to lose his good right hand. I'll go further. It happened because he was scared of what might happen, what Andy might say against him if Andy ever got clear of Shawshank State Prison. I got the story a chunk here and a chunk there over a space of 7 years, some of it from Andy, but not all. He never wanted to talk about that part of his life, and I don't blame him. I got parts of it from maybe half a dozen different sources. I've said once that prisoners are nothing but slaves, but they have that slave habit of looking dumb and keeping their ears open. I got it backwards and forwards and in the middle, but I'll give it to you from point A to point Z, and maybe you'll understand why the man spent about 10 months in a bleak, depressed daze. See, I don't think he knew the truth until 1963, 15 years after he came into this sweet little hellhole. Until he met Tommy Williams, I don't think he knew how bad it could get. Tommy Williams joined our happy little Shawshank family in November of 1962. Tommy thought of himself as a native of Massachusetts, but he wasn't proud. In his 27 years, he'd done time all over New England. He was a professional thief, and as you may have guessed, my own feeling was that he should have picked another profession. He was a married man, and his wife came to visit each and every week. She had an idea that things might go better with Tommy, and consequently better with their 3-year-old son and herself, if he got his high school degree. She talked him into it, and so Tommy Williams started visiting the library on a regular basis. For Andy, this was an old routine by then. He saw that Tommy got a series of high school equivalency tests. Tommy would brush up on the subjects he had passed in high school, there weren't many, and then take the test. Andy also saw that he was enrolled in a number of correspondence courses covering the subjects he had failed in school or just missed by dropping out. He probably wasn't the best student Andy ever took over the jumps, and I don't know if he ever did get his high school diploma, but that forms no part of my story. The important thing was that he came to like Andy Dufresne very much, as most people did after a while. On a couple of occasions, he asked Andy what a smart guy like you is doing in the joint, a question which is the rough equivalent of one that goes, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" But Andy wasn't the type to tell him. He would only smile and turn the conversation into some other channel. Quite normally, Tommy asked someone else, and when he finally got the story, I guess he also got the shock of his young life. The person he asked was his partner on the laundry's steam ironer and folder. The inmates call this device the mangler because that's exactly what it'll do to you if you aren't paying attention and get your bad self caught in it. His partner was Charlie Lathrop, who had been in for about 12 years on a murder charge. He was more than glad to reheat the details of the Dufresne murder trial for Tommy. It broke the monotony of pulling freshly pressed bedsheets out of the machine and tucking them into the basket. He was just getting to the jury, waiting until after lunch to bring in their guilty verdict, when the trouble whistle went off and the mangle grated to a stop. They had been feeding in freshly washed sheets from the Elliott nursing home at the far end. These were spat out dry and neatly pressed at Tommy's and Charlie's end at the rate of 1 every 5 seconds. Their job was to grab them, fold them, and slap them into the cart, which had already been lined with clean brown paper. But Tommy Williams was just standing there, staring at Charlie Lathrop, his mouth unhinged all the way to his chest. He was standing in a drift of sheets that had come through clean and which were now sopping up all the wet muck on the floor. And in a laundry wet wash, there's plenty of muck. So the head bull that day, Homer Jessup, comes rushing over, bellowing his head off and on the prod for trouble. Tommy took no notice of him. He spoke to Charlie as if old Homer, who had busted more heads than he could probably count, hadn't been there. "What did you say that golf pro's name was?" "Quentin," Charlie answered back, all confused and upset by now. He later said that the kid was white as a truce flag. "Glenn Quentin, I think, something like that anyway." Here now," Homer Jessup roared, his neck as red as a rooster's comb. "Get them sheets in cold water. Get quick, by Jesus, you—" "Glenn Quentin. Oh, my God," Tommy Williams said, and that was all he got to say because Homer Jessup, that least peaceable of men, brought his billy down behind his ear. Tommy hit the floor so hard he broke off three of his front teeth. When he woke up, he was in solitary and confined to same for a week, riding a boxcar on Sam Norton's famous grain and drain train, plus a black mark on his report card. That was in early February of 1963, and Tommy Williams went around to six or seven other long-timers after he got out of solitary and got pretty much the same story. I know I was one of them. But when I asked him why he wanted it, he just clammed up. Then one day he went to the library and spilled one hell of a big budget of information to Andy Dufresne. And for the first and last time, at least since he had approached me about the Rita Hayworth poster like a kid buying his first pack of Trojans, Andy lost his cool. Only this time, he blew it entirely. I saw him later that day, and he looked like a man who had stepped on the business end of a rake and given himself a good one, whap, between the eyes. His hands were trembling, and when I spoke to him, he didn't answer. Before that afternoon was out, he had caught up with Billy Hanlon, who was the head screw, and set up an appointment with Warden Norton for the following day. He told me later that he didn't sleep a wink all that night. He just listened to a cold winter wind howling outside, watched the searchlights go around and around, putting long, moving shadows on the cement walls of the cage he had called home since Harry Truman was president, and tried to think it all out. He said it was as if Tommy had produced a key which fit a cage in the back of his mind, a cage like his own cell. Only instead of holding a man, that cage held a tiger, and that tiger's name was Hope. Williams had produced the key that unlocked the cage, and the tiger was out, willy-nilly, to roam his brain. 4 years before, Tommy Williams had been arrested in Rhode Island, driving a stolen car that was full of stolen merchandise. Tommy turned in his accomplice, the DA played ball, and he got a lighter sentence, 2 to 4 with time served. 11 months after beginning his term, his old cellmate got a ticket out, and Tommy got a new one, a man named Elwood Blatch. Blatch had been busted for burglary with a weapon and was serving 6 to 12. "I've never seen such a high-strung guy," Tommy told me. "A man like that should never want to be a burglar, especially not with a gun. The slightest little noise he'd go 3 feet into the air and come down shooting, more likely than not. One night he almost strangled me because some guy down the hall was whopping on his cell bars with a tin cup. I did 7 months with him until they let me walk free. I got time served and time off, you understand. I can't say we talked because you didn't, you know, exactly hold a conversation with L. Blatch. He held a conversation with you. He talked all the time, never shut up. If you tried to get a word in, he'd shake his fist at you and roll his eyes. It gave me the cold chills whenever he done that. Big, tall guy he was, mostly bald, with these green eyes set way down deep in the sockets. Jeez, I hope I never see him again. It was like a talking jag every night. Where he grew up, the orphanages he'd run away from, the jobs he'd done, the women he'd fucked, the crap games he'd cleaned out, I just let him run on. My face ain't much, but I didn't want it, you know, rearranged for me. According to him, he'd burgled over 200 joints. It was hard for me to believe a guy like him who went off like a firecracker every time someone cut a loud fart, but he swore it was true. Now, listen to me, Red, I know guys sometimes make things up after they know a thing, but even before I knew about this golf pro guy, Quentin, I remember thinking that if L. Blatch ever burgled my house and I found out about it later, I'd have to count myself just about the luckiest motherfucker going still to be alive. Can you imagine him in some lady's bedroom sifting through her jewelry box and she coughs in her sleep or turns over quick? Gives me the cold chills just to think of something like that. I swear on my mother's name it does. He said he'd killed people, too. People that gave him shit. At least that's what he said. And I believed him. He sure looked like a man who could do some killing. He was just so fucking high-strung. Like a pistol with a sawed-off firing pin. I knew a guy who had a Smith & Wesson police special with a sawed-off firing pin. It wasn't no good for nothing, except maybe for something to jaw about. The pull on that gun was so light that it would fire if this guy, Johnny Callahan his name was, if he turned his record player on full volume and put it on top of one of the speakers. That's how L. Blatch was. I can't explain it any better. I just never doubted that he had greased some people. So one night, just for something to say, I go, "Who'd you kill?" Like a joke, you know, so he laughs and says, "There's one guy doing time up Maine for these two people I killed. It was this guy and the wife of the slob is doing the time. I was creeping their place and the guy started to give me some shit." I can't remember if he ever told me the woman's name or not, Tommy went on. Maybe he did. But in New England, Dufresne's like Smith or Jones in the rest of the country, because there's so many frogs up here. Dufresne, Levesque, Ouellette, Poulin, who can remember frog names? But he told me the guy's name. He said the guy was Glenn Quentin, and he was a prick, a big, rich prick, a golf pro. Al said he thought the guy might have cash in the house, maybe as much as $5,000. That was a lot of money back then, he says to me, so I go, "When was that?" And he goes, "After the war, just after the war." So he went in and he did the joint, and they woke up and the guy gave him some trouble. That's what Els said. Maybe the guy just started to snore, that's what I say. Anyway, Els said Quentin was in the sack with some hot-shot lawyer's wife, and they sent the lawyer up to Shawshank State Prison. Then he laughs this big laugh. Holy Christ, I was never so glad of anything as I was when I got my walking papers from that place. I guess you can see why Andy went a little wonky when Tommy told him that story, and why he wanted to see the warden right away. Elwood Blatch had been serving a 6-to-12 rap when Tommy knew him 4 years before. By the time Andy heard all of this in 1963, he might be on the verge of getting out, or already out. So those were the two prongs of the spit Andy was roasting on. The idea that Blatch might still be in, on one hand, and the very real possibility that he might be gone like the wind on the other. There were inconsistencies in Tommy's story, but aren't there always in real life? Blatch told Tommy the man who got sent up was a hotshot lawyer, and Andy was a banker. But those are two professions that people who aren't very educated could easily get mixed up. And don't forget that 12 years had gone by between the time Blatch was reading the clippings about the trial and the time he told the tale to Tommy Williams. He also told Tommy he got better than $1,000 from a footlocker Quentin had in his closet, but the police said at Andy's trial that there had been no sign of burglary. I have a few ideas about that. First, if you take the cash and the man it belonged to is dead, how are you going to know anything was stolen, unless someone else can tell you it was there to start with? Second, who's to say Blatch wasn't lying about that part of it? Maybe he didn't want to admit killing two people for nothing. Third, maybe there were signs of burglary and the cops either overlooked them, cops can be pretty dumb, or deliberately covered them up so they wouldn't screw the DA's case. The guy was running for public office, remember, and he needed a conviction to run on. An unsolved burglary murder would have done him no good at all. But of the three, I like the middle one best. I've known a few Elwood Blatches in my time at Shawshank, the trigger pullers with the crazy eyes. Such fellows want you to think they got away with the equivalent of the Hope Diamond on every caper, even if they got caught with a $2 Timex and $9 on the one they're doing time for. And there was one thing in Tommy's story that convinced Andy beyond a shadow of a doubt. Blatch hadn't hit Quentin at random. He had called Quentin a big, rich prick, and he had known Quentin was a golf pro. Well, Andy and his wife had been going out to that country club for drinks and dinner once or twice a week for a couple of years, and Andy had done a considerable amount of drinking there once he found out about his wife's affair. There was a marina with the country club, and for a while in 1947 there had been a part-time grease and gas jockey working there who matched Tommy's description of Elwood Blatch, a big, tall man, mostly bald, with deep-set green eyes, a man who had an unpleasant way of looking at you, as though he was sizing you up. He wasn't there long, Andy said. Either he quit, or Briggs, the fellow in charge of the marina, fired him. But he wasn't a man you forgot. He was too striking for that. So Andy went to see Warden Norton on a rainy, windy day, with big gray clouds scudding across the sky above the gray walls, a day when the last of the snow was starting to melt away and show lifeless patches of last year's grass in the fields beyond the prison. The warden has a good-sized office in the administration wing, and behind the warden's desk there's a door which connects with the assistant warden's office. The assistant warden was out that day, but a trustee was there, He was a half-lame fellow whose real name I have forgotten. All the inmates, me included, called him Chester, after Marshal Dillon's sidekick. Chester was supposed to be watering the plants and waxing the floor. My guess is that the plants went thirsty that day, and the only waxing that was done happened because of Chester's dirty ear polishing the keyhole plate of that connecting door. He heard the warden's main door open and close, and then Norton saying, "Good morning, Dufresne. How can I help you?" "Warden," Andy began, and old Chester told us that he could hardly recognize Andy's voice, it was so changed. "Warden, there's something's happened to me that's so I hardly know where to begin." "Well, why don't you just begin at the beginning?" the warden said, probably in his sweetest let's all turn to the 23rd Psalm and read in unison voice. That usually works the best. And so Andy did. He began by refreshing Norton on the details of the crime he had been imprisoned for. Then he told the warden exactly what Tommy Williams had told him. He also gave out Tommy's name, which you may think wasn't so wise in light of later developments, but I'd just ask you what else he could have done if his story was to have any credibility at all. When he had finished, Norton was completely silent for some time. I can just see him, probably tipped back in his office chair under the picture of Governor Reed hanging on the wall, his fingers steepled, his liver lips pursed, his brow wrinkled into ladder rungs halfway to the crown of his head, his 30-year pin gleaming mellowly. "Yes," he said finally, "that's the damnedest story I ever heard. But I'll tell you what surprises me most about it, Dufresne." "What's that, sir?" "That you were taken in by it." "Sir, I don't understand what you mean." And Chester said that Andy Dufresne, who had faced down Byron Hadley on the plate shop roof 13 years before, was almost floundering for words. "Well now," Norton said, "it's pretty obvious to me that this young fellow Williams is impressed with you, quite taken with you, as a matter of fact. He hears your tale of woe, and it's quite natural of him to want to cheer you up, let's say. Quite natural. He's a young man, not terribly bright, not surprising. He didn't realize what a state it would put you into. Now, what I suggest is..." "Don't you think I thought of that?" Andy asked. "But I never told Tommy about the man working down at the marina. I never told anyone that. It never even crossed my mind. But Tommy's description of his cellmate and that man, they're identical." "Well, now, you may be indulging in a little selective perception there," Norton said with a chuckle. Phrases like that, selective perception, are required learning for people in the penology and corrections business, and they use them all they can. "That's not it at all, sir." "That's your slant on it," Norton said. "But mine differs. And let's remember that I have only your word that there was such a man working at the Falmouth Hills Country Club back then." "No, sir," Andy broke in again. "No, that isn't true, because..." "Anyway," Norton overrode him, expansive and loud, "let's just look at it from the other end of the telescope, shall we? Suppose, just suppose now, that there really was a fellow named Elwood Blotch." "Blatch," Andy said tightly. "Blatch, by all means. And let's say he was Thomas Williams' cellmate in Rhode Island. The chances are excellent that he has been released by now. Excellent. Why, we don't even know how much time he might have done there before he ended up with Williams, do we? Only that he was doing a 6 to 12. "No, we don't know how much time he'd done. But Tommy said he was a bad actor, a cut-up. I think there's a fair chance that he may still be in. Even if he's been released, the prison will have a record of his last known address, the names of his relatives, and both would almost certainly be dead ends." Andy was silent for a moment, and then he burst out, "Well, it's a chance, isn't it?" "Yes, of course it is. So just for the moment, Dufresne, let's assume that Blatch exists, and that he is still safely ensconced in the Rhode Island State Penitentiary. Now, what is he going to say if we bring this kettle of fish to him in a bucket? Is he going to fall down on his knees, roll his eyes, and say, 'I did it, I did it, by all means add a life term onto my charge'?" "How can you be so obtuse?" Andy said, so low that Chester could barely hear. But he heard the warden just fine. "What? What did you call me?" "Obtuse," Andy cried. "Is it deliberate?" "Dufresne, you've taken 5 minutes of my time. No, 7. And I have a very busy schedule today. So I believe we'll just declare this little meeting closed, and the country club will have all the old-time cards. Don't you realize that? Andy shouted. They'll have tax forms and W-2s and unemployment compensation forms, all with his name on them. There will be employees there now that were there then, maybe Briggs himself. It's been 15 years, not forever. They'll remember him. They will remember Blatch. If I've got Tommy to testify to what Blatch told him, and Briggs to testify that Blatch was there, actually working at the country club, I can get a new trial. I can... Guard, take this man away. What's the matter with you? Andy said, and Chester told me he was very nearly screaming by then. It's my life, my chance to get out, don't you see that? And you won't make a single long-distance call to at least verify Tommy's story? Listen, I'll pay for the call. I'll pay for... And then there was the sound of thrashing as the guards grabbed him and started to drag him out. Solitary, Warden Norton said dryly. He was probably fingering his 30-year pin as he said it. Bread and water. And so they dragged Andy away, totally out of control now, still screaming at the warden. Chester said you could hear him even after the door was shut. It's my life! It's my life! Don't you understand? It's my life! 20 days on the grain and drain train for Andy, down there in solitary. It was his second jolt in solitary, and his dust-up with Norton was his first real black mark since he had joined our happy little family. I'll tell you a little bit about Shawshank Solitary while we're on the subject. It's something of a throwback to those hardy pioneer days of the early to mid-1700s in Maine. In those days, no one wasted much time with such things as penology and rehabilitation and selective perception. In those days, you were taken care of in terms of absolute black and white. You were either guilty or innocent. If you were guilty, you were either hung or put in jail. And if you were sentenced to jail, you did not go to an institution. No, you dug your own jail with a spade provided by the province of Maine. You dug it as wide and as deep as you could during the period between sunup and sundown. Then they gave you a couple of skins and a bucket, and down you went. Once down, the jailer would bar the top of your hole, throw down some grain or maybe a piece of maggoty meat once or twice a week, and maybe there would be a dipperful of barley soup on Sunday night. You pissed in the bucket, and you held up the same bucket for water when the jailer came round at 6 in the morning. When it rained, you used the bucket to bail out your jail cell. Unless, that is, you wanted to drown like a rat in a rain barrel. No one spent a long time in the hole, as it was called. 30 months was an unusually long term. And so far as I've been able to tell, the longest term ever spent from which an inmate actually emerged alive was served by the so-called Durham Boy, a 14-year-old psychopath who castrated a schoolmate with a piece of rusty metal. He did 7 years, but of course he went in young and strong. You have to remember that for a crime that was more serious than petty theft or blasphemy or forgetting to put a snot rag in your pocket when out of doors on the Sabbath, you were hung. For low crimes, such as those just mentioned, and for others like them, you do your 3 or 6 or 9 months in the hole and come out fish-belly white, cringing from the wide-open spaces, your eyes half-blind, your teeth more than likely rocking and rolling in their sockets from the scurvy, your feet crawling with fungus. Jolly old province of Maine. Yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. Shawshank's solitary wing was nowhere as bad as that. I guess. Things come in 3 major degrees in the human experience, I think. There's good, bad, and terrible. And as you go down into progressive darkness towards terrible, it gets harder and harder to make subdivisions. To get to solitary wing, you were led down 23 steps to a basement level where the only sound was the drip of water. The only light was supplied by a series of dangling 60-watt bulbs. The cells were keg-shaped, like those wall safes rich people sometimes hide behind a picture. Like a safe, the round doorways were hinged and solid instead of barred. You got ventilation from above, but no light except from your own 60-watt bulb, which was turned off from a master switch promptly at 8 p.m., an hour before lights out in the rest of the prison. The light bulb wasn't in a wire mesh cage or anything like that. The feeling was that if you wanted to exist down there in the dark, you were welcome to it. Not many did. But after 8, of course, you had no choice. You had a bunk bolted to the wall and a can with no toilet seat. You had 3 ways to spend your time: sitting, shitting, or sleeping. Big choice. 20 days could get to seem like a year. 30 days could seem like 2. And 40 days like 10. Sometimes you could hear rats in the ventilation system. In a situation like that, subdivisions of terrible tend to get lost. If anything at all can be said in favor of solitary, it's just that you get time to think. Andy had 20 days in which to think while he enjoyed his grain and drain, and when he got out, he requested another meeting with the warden. Request denied. Such a meeting, the warden told him, would be counterproductive. That's another one of those phrases you have to master before you can go to work in the prison and corrections field. Patiently, Andy renewed his request, and renewed it, and renewed it. He had changed, had Andy Dufresne. Suddenly, as that spring of 1963 bloomed around us, there were lines in his face and sprigs of gray showing in his hair. He had lost that little trace of a smile that always seemed to linger around his mouth. His eyes stared out into space more often. And you get to know that when a man stares that way, he is counting up the years served, the months, the weeks, the days. He renewed his request and renewed it. He was patient. He had nothing but time. It got to be summer. In Washington, President Kennedy was promising a fresh assault on poverty and on civil rights inequalities, not knowing he had only half a year to live. In Liverpool, a musical group called the Beatles was emerging as a force to be reckoned with in British music. But I guess that no one stateside had yet heard of them. The Boston Red Sox, still 4 years away from what New England folks call the miracle of 67, were languishing in the cellar of the American League. All of those things were going on out in a larger world where people walked free. Norton saw him near the end of June, and this conversation I heard about from Andy himself some 7 years later. "If it's the squeeze, you don't have to worry," Andy told Norton in a low voice. "Do you think I'd talk that up? I'd be cutting my own throat. I'd be just as indictable as..." "That's enough," Norton interrupted. His face was as long and cold as a slate gravestone. He leaned back in his office chair until the back of his head almost touched the sampler reading "His judgment cometh in that right early." "But don't you ever mention money to me again," Norton said. "Not in this office, not anywhere. Not unless you want to see that library turned back into a storage room and paint locker again. Do you understand?" "I was trying to set your mind at ease, that's all." "Well, now, when I need a sorry son of a bitch like you to set my mind at ease, I'll retire. I agreed to this appointment because I got tired of being pestered, Dufresne. I wanted to stop. If you want to buy this particular Brooklyn Bridge, that's your affair. Don't make it mine. I could hear crazy stories like yours twice a week if I wanted to lay myself open to them. Every sinner in this place would be using me for a crying towel. I had more respect for you. But this is the end. The end. Have we got an understanding?" "Yes," Andy said. "But I'll be hiring a lawyer, you know." "What in God's name for?" "I think we can put it together," Andy said. "With Tommy Williams and with my testimony and corroborative testimony from records and employees at the country club, I think we can put it together." "Tommy Williams is no longer an inmate of this facility." "What?" "He's been transferred."
"Transferred where?"
"Cashman." At that, Andy fell silent. He was an intelligent man, but it would have taken an extraordinarily stupid man not to smell deal all over that. Cashman was a minimum security prison far up north in Aroostook County. The inmates pick a lot of potatoes, and that's hard work, but they are paid a decent wage for their labor, and they can attend classes at CVI, a pretty decent vocational technical institute, if they so desire. More important to a fellow like Tommy, a fellow with a young wife and a child, Cashman had a furlough program, which meant a chance to live like a normal man, at least on the weekends. A chance to build a model plane with his kid, have sex with his wife, maybe go on a picnic. Norton had almost surely dangled all of that under Tommy's nose, with only one string attached. Not one more word about Elwood Blatch. Not now, not ever. Or you'll end up doing hard time in Thomaston, down there on scenic Route 1, with the real hard guys, and instead of having sex with your wife, you'll be having it with some old bull queer. But why, Andy said. Why would, as a favor to you, Norton said calmly. I checked with Rhode Island. They did have an inmate named Elwood Blatch. He was given what they call a PP, provisional parole, another one of those crazy liberal programs to put criminals out on the streets. He's since disappeared. Andy said, the warden down there, is he a friend of yours? Sam Norton gave Andy a smile as cold as a deacon's watch chain. We are acquainted, he said. Why? Andy repeated. Can't you tell me why you did it? You knew I wasn't going to talk about anything you might have had going. You knew that, so why? Because people like you make me sick, Norton said deliberately. I like you right where you are, Mr. Dufresne, and as long as I am warden here at Shawshank, you are going to be right here. You see, you used to think that you were better than anyone else. I have gotten pretty good at seeing that on a man's face. I marked it on yours the first time I walked into the library. It might as well have been written on your forehead in capital letters. That look is gone now, and I like that just fine. It is not just that you are a useful vessel. Never think that. It is simply that men like you need to learn humility. Why, you used to walk around that exercise yard as if it was a living room, and you were at one of these cocktail parties where the hellbound walk around coveting each other's wives and husbands and getting swinishly drunk. But you don't walk around that way anymore, and I'll be watching to see if you should start to walk that way again. Over a period of years, I'll be watching you with great pleasure. Now get the hell out of here. Okay, but all the extracurricular activities stop now, Norton. The investment counseling, the scams, the free tax advice, it all stops. Get H&R Block to tell you how to declare your income. Warden Norton's face first went brick red, and then all the color fell out of it. You're going back into solitary for that. 30 days, bread and water. Another black mark. And while you're in, think about this. If anything that's been going on should stop, the library goes. I will make it my personal business to see that it goes back to what it was before you came here. And I will make your life very hard, very difficult. You'll do the hardest time it's possible to do. You'll lose that one bunk Hilton down in cell block 5 for starters, and you'll lose those rocks on the windowsill, and you'll lose any protection the guards have given you against the sodomites. You will lose everything. Clear? I guess it was clear enough. Time continued to pass. The oldest trick in the world, and maybe the only one that really is magic. But Andy Dufresne had changed. He had grown harder. That's the only way I can think of to put it. He went on doing Warden Norton's dirty work, and he held on to the library, so outwardly things were about the same. He continued to have his birthday drinks and his year-end holiday drinks. He continued to share out the rest of each bottle. I got him fresh rock-polishing cloths from time to time, and in 1967 I got him a new rock hammer. The one I'd gotten him 19 years ago had, as I told you, plumb worn out. 19 years! When you say it sudden like that, those three syllables sound like the thud and double locking of a tomb door. The rock hammer, which had been a $10 item back then, went for 22 by 67. He and I had a sad little grin over that. Andy continued to shape and polish the rocks he found in the exercise yard, but the yard was smaller by then. Half of what had been there in 1950 had been asphalted over in 1962. Nonetheless, he found enough to keep him occupied, I guess. When he had finished with each rock, he would put it carefully on his window ledge, which faced east. He told me he liked to look at them in the sun, the pieces of the planet he had taken up from the dirt and shaped. Schists, quartzes, granites, funny little mica sculptures that were held together with airplane glue, various sedimentary conglomerates that were polished and cut in such a way that you could see why Andy called them millennium sandwiches, the layers of different material that had built up over a period of decades and centuries. Andy would give his stones and his rock sculptures away from time to time in order to make room for new ones. He gave me the greatest number, I think, counting the stones that looked like matched cufflinks. I had 5. There was one of the mica sculptures I told you about, carefully crafted to look like a man throwing a javelin, and 2 of the sedimentary conglomerates, all the levels showing in smoothly polished cross-section. I've still got them, and I take them down every so often and think about what a man can do if he has time enough and the will to use it, a drop at a time. So, on the outside at least, things were about the same. If Norton had wanted to break Andy as badly as he had said, he would have had to look below the surface to see the change. But if he had seen how different Andy had become, I think Norton would have been well satisfied with the 4 years following his clash with Andy. He had told Andy that Andy walked around the exercise yard as if he were at a cocktail party. That isn't the way I would have put it, but I know what he meant. It goes back to what I said about Andy wearing his freedom like an invisible coat, about how he never really developed a prison mentality. His eyes never got that dull look. He never developed the walk that men get when a day is over and they are going back to their cells for another endless night, that flat-footed, hump-shouldered walk. Andy walked with his shoulders squared, and his step was always light, as if he were heading home to a good home-cooked meal and a good woman, instead of to a tasteless mess of soggy vegetables, lumpy mashed potato, and a slice or two of that fatty, gristly stuff most of the cons called mystery meat. That, and a picture of Raquel Welch on the wall. But for those 4 years, although he never became exactly like the others, he did become silent, introspective, and brooding. Who could blame him? So maybe it was Warden Norton who was pleased, at least for a while. His dark mood broke around the time of the 1967 World Series. That was the dream year, the year the Red Sox won the pennant instead of placing 9th, as the Las Vegas bookies had predicted. When it happened, when they won the American League pennant, a kind of ebullience engulfed the whole prison. There was a goofy sort of feeling that if the dead Sox could come to life, then maybe anybody could do it. I can't explain that feeling now any more than an ex-Beatle maniac could explain that madness, I suppose. But it was real. Every radio in the place was tuned to the games as the Red Sox pounded down the stretch. There was gloom when the Sox dropped a pair in Cleveland near the end, and a nearly riotous joy when Rico Petrocelli put away the pop fly that clinched it. And then there was the gloom that came when Lundberg was beaten in the 7th game of the series to end the dream just short of complete fruition. It probably pleased Norton to no end, the son of a bitch. He liked his prison wearing sackcloth and ashes. But for Andy, there was no tumble back down into gloom. He wasn't much of a baseball fan anyway, and maybe that was why. Nevertheless, he seemed to have caught the current of good feeling, and for him it didn't peter out again after the last game of the series. He had taken that invisible coat out of the closet and put it on again. I remember one bright gold fall day in very late October, a couple of weeks after the World Series had ended. It must have been a Sunday, because the exercise yard was full of men walking off the week, tossing a frisbee or two, passing around a football, bartering what they had to barter. Others would be at the long table in the visitors' hall, under the watchful eyes of the screws, talking with their relatives, smoking cigarettes, telling sincere lies, receiving their picked-over care packages. Andy was squatting, Indian fashion, against the wall, chunking 2 small rocks together in his hands, his face turned up into the sunlight. It was surprisingly warm, that sun, for a day so late in the year. "Hello, Red," he called. "Come on and sit a spell." I did. "You want this?" he asked, and handed me one of the two carefully polished Millennium sandwiches I just told you about. "I sure do," I said. "It's very pretty, thank you." He shrugged and changed the subject. "Big anniversary coming up for you next year." I nodded. Next year would make me a 30-year man. 60% of my life spent in Shawshank State Prison. "Think you'll ever get out?" "Sure. When I have a long white beard and just about 3 marbles left rolling around upstairs." He smiled a little and then turned his face up into the sun again, his eyes closed. "Feels good." "I think it always does when you know the damn winter's almost right on top of you." He nodded, and we were silent for a while. "When I get out of here," Andy said finally, "I'm going where it's warm all the time." He spoke with such calm assurance, you would have thought he had only a month or so left to serve. "You know where I'm going, Red?"
"Nope."
"Ziwataneho," he said, rolling the word softly from his tongue like music. "Down in Mexico. It's a little place maybe 20 miles from Playa Azul and Mexico Highway 37. It's 100 miles northwest of Acapulco on the Pacific Ocean. Do you know what the Mexicans say about the Pacific?" I told him I didn't. "They say it has no memory. And that's where I want to finish out my life, Red. In a warm place that has no memory." He had picked up a handful of pebbles as he spoke. Now he tossed them one by one and watched them bounce and roll across the baseball diamond's dirt infield, which would be under a foot of snow before long. "Ziwataneho. I'm going to have a little hotel down there. 6 cabanas along the beach and 6 more set further back for the highway trade. I'll have a guy who'll take my guests out charter fishing. There'll be a trophy for the guy who catches the biggest marlin of the season, and I'll put his picture up in the lobby. It won't be a family place. It'll be a place for people on their honeymoons, first or second varieties." "And where are you going to get the money to buy this fabulous place?" I asked. "Your stock account?" He looked at me and smiled. "That's not so far wrong," he said. "Sometimes you startle me, Red." "What are you talking about?" "There are really only 2 types of men in the world when it comes to bad trouble," Andy said, cupping a match between his hands and lighting a cigarette. "Suppose there was a house full of rare paintings and sculptures and fine old antiques, Red, and suppose the guy who owned the house heard that there was a monster of a hurricane headed right at it. One of those 2 kinds of men just hopes for the best. The hurricane will change course," he says to himself. "No right-thinking hurricane would ever dare wipe out all these Rembrandts, my 2 Degas horses, my Grant Woods, and my Bentons. Furthermore, God wouldn't allow it. And if worse comes to worst, they're insured." That's one sort of man. The other sort just assumes that hurricane is going to tear right through the middle of his house. If the Weather Bureau says the hurricane just changed course, this guy assumes it'll change back in order to put his house on ground zero again. This second type of guy knows there's no harm in hoping for the best, as long as you're prepared for the worst. I lit a cigarette of my own. "Are you saying you prepared for the eventuality?" "Yes. I prepared for the hurricane. I knew how bad it looked. I didn't have much time, but in the time I had, I operated. I had a friend, just about the only person who stood by me, who worked for an investment company in Portland. He died about 6 years ago. Sorry." "Yeah." Andy tossed his butt away. "Linda and I had about $14,000. Not a big bundle, but, well, we were young. We had our whole lives ahead of us." He grimaced a little, then laughed. "When the shit hit the fan, I started lugging my Rembrandts out of the path of the hurricane. I sold my stocks and paid the capital gains tax just like a good little boy. Declared everything. Didn't cut any corners." "Didn't they freeze your estate?" "I was charged with murder, Red, not dead. You can't freeze the assets of an innocent man, thank God. And it was a while before they even got brave enough to charge me with the crime. Jim, my friend, and I, we had some time. I got hit pretty good, just dumping everything like that. Got my nose skinned. But at the time, I had worse things to worry about than a small skinning on the stock market. Yeah, I'd say you did. But when I came to Shawshank, it was all safe. It's still safe. Outside these walls, Red, there's a man that no living soul has ever seen face to face. He has a social security card and a Maine driver's license. He's got a birth certificate, name of Peter Stevens. Nice, anonymous name, huh? Who is he? I asked. I thought I knew what he was going to say, but I couldn't believe it. Me. You're not going to tell me that you had time to set up a false identity while the bulls were sweating you, I said. Or that you finished a job while you were on trial for... No, I'm not going to tell you that. My friend Jim was the one who set up the false identity. He started after my appeal was turned down, and the major pieces of identification were in his hands by the spring of 1950. He must have been a pretty close friend, I said. I was not sure how much of this I believed. A little, a lot, or none. But the day was warm and the sun was out, and it was one hell of a good story. All of that's 100% illegal, setting up a false ID like that. He was a close friend, Andy said. We were in the war together. France, Germany, the occupation. He was a good friend. He knew it was illegal, but he also knew that setting up a false identity in this country is very easy and very safe. He took my money with all the taxes on it paid so the IRS wouldn't get too interested, and invested it for Peter Stevens. He did that in 1950 and 1951. Today it amounts to $370,000 plus change. I guess my jaw made a thump when it dropped against my chest because he smiled. Think of all the things people wish they'd invested in since 1950 or so, and two or three of them will be things Peter Stevens was into. If I hadn't ended up in here, I'd probably be worth $7 or $8 million by now. I'd have a Rolls and probably an ulcer as big as a portable radio. His hands went to the dirt and began sifting out more pebbles. They moved gracefully, restlessly. It was hoping for the best and expecting the worst. Nothing but that. The false name was just to keep what little capital I had untainted. It was lugging the paintings out of the path of the hurricane. But I had no idea that the hurricane... that it could go on as long as it has. I didn't say anything for a while. I guess I was trying to absorb the idea that this small, spare man in prison gray next to me could be worth more money than Warden Norton would make in the rest of his miserable life, even with the scams thrown in. "When you said you could get a lawyer, you sure weren't kidding," I said at last. "For that kind of dough, you could have hired Clarence Darrow, or whoever's passing for him these days. Why didn't you, Andy? Christ! You could have been out of here like a rocket." He smiled. It was the same smile that had been on his face when he told me he and his wife had had their whole lives ahead of them. "No," he said. "A good lawyer would have sprung the Williams kid from Cashman whether he wanted to go or not," I said. I was getting carried away now. "You could have gotten your new trial, hired private detectives to look for that guy Blatch, and blown Norton out of the water to boot. Why not, Andy?" "Because I outsmarted myself. If I ever try to put my hands on Peter Stevens' money from inside here, I'll lose every cent of it. My friend Jim could have arranged it, but Jim's dead. You see the problem?" I saw it. For all the good that money could do Andy, it might as well have really belonged to another person. In a way, it did. And if the stuff it was invested in suddenly turned bad, all Andy could do would be to watch the plunge, to trace it day after day on the stocks and bonds page of the Press Herald. It's a tough life if you don't weaken, I guess. "I'll tell you how it is, Red. There's a big hayfield in the town of Buxton. You know where Buxton is at, don't you?" I said I did. "It lies right next door to Scarborough." "That's right. And at the north end of this particular hayfield, there's a rock wall right out of a Robert Frost poem. and somewhere along the base of that wall is a rock that has no business in a Maine hayfield. It's a piece of volcanic glass, and until 1947 it was a paperweight on my office desk. My friend Jim put it in that wall. There's a key underneath it. The key opens a safe deposit box in the Portland branch of the Casco Bank. I guess you're in a peck of trouble, I said. When your friend Jim died, the IRS must have opened all of his safe deposit boxes, along with the executor of his will, of course. Andy smiled and tapped the side of my head. Not bad. There's more up there than marshmallows, I guess. But we took care of the possibility that Jim might die while I was in the slam. The box is in the Peter Stevens name, and once a year the firm of lawyers that served as Jim's executors sends a check to the Casco to cover the rental of the Stevens box. Peter Stevens is inside that box, just waiting to get out. His birth certificate, his Social Security card, and his driver's license. The license is 6 years out of date because Jim died 6 years ago, true, but it's still perfectly renewable for a $5 fee. His stock certificates are there, the tax-free municipals, and about 18 bearer bonds in the amount of $10,000 each. I whistled. Peter Stevens is locked in a safe deposit box at the Casco Bank in Portland, and Andy Dufresne is locked in a safe deposit box at Shawshank, he said, tit for tat. And the key that unlocks the box and the money and the new life is under a hunk of black glass in a Buxton hayfield. Told you this much, or I'll tell you something else, Red. For the last 20 years, give or take, I have been watching the papers with a more than usual interest for news of any construction project in Buxton. I keep thinking that someday soon I'm going to read that they're putting a highway through there, or erecting a new community hospital, or building a shopping center, burying my new life under 10 feet of concrete, or spitting it into a swamp somewhere with a big load of fill. I blurted. Jesus Christ, Andy, if all of this is true, how do you keep from going crazy? He smiled. So far, all quiet on the Western Front. But it could be years. It will be. But maybe not as many as the state and Warden Norton think it's going to be. I just can't afford to wait that long. I keep thinking about Zihuatanejo and that small hotel. That's all I want from my life now, Red, and I don't think that's too much to want. I didn't kill Glenn Quentin, and I didn't kill my wife. And that hotel, it's not too much to want. To swim, and get a tan, and sleep in a room with open windows and space, that's not too much to want. He slung the stones away. You know, Red, he said in an offhand voice, a place like that, I'd have to have a man who knows how to get things. I thought about it for a long time, and the biggest drawback in my mind wasn't even that we were talking pipe dreams in a shitty little prison exercise yard with armed guards looking down at us from their sentry posts. I couldn't do it, I said. I couldn't get along on the outside. I'm what they call an institutional man now. In here, I'm the man who can get it for you, yeah, but out there, anyone can get it for you. Out there, if you want posters or rock hammers or one particular record or a boat-in-a-bottle model kit, you can use the fucking Yellow Pages. In here, I'm the fucking Yellow Pages. I wouldn't know how to begin or where. You underestimate yourself, he said. You're a self-educated man, a self-made man, a rather remarkable man, I think. Hell, I don't even have a high school diploma. I know that, he said, but it isn't just a piece of paper that makes a man, and it isn't just prison that breaks one either. I couldn't hack it outside, Andy. I know that. He got up. You think it over, he said casually, just as the inside whistle blew, and he strolled off, as if he were a free man who had just made another free man a proposition. And for a while, just that was enough to make me feel free. Andy could do that. He could make me forget for a time that we were both lifers at the mercy of a hard-ass parole board and a psalm-singing warden who liked Andy Dufresne right where he was. After all, Andy was a lapdog who could do tax returns. What a wonderful animal. But by that night in my cell, I felt like a prisoner again. The whole idea seemed absurd, and that mental image of blue water and white beaches seemed more cruel than foolish.
It dragged at my brain like a fishhook. I just couldn't wear that invisible coat the way Andy did. I fell asleep that night and dreamed of a great, glassy, black stone in the middle of a hayfield, a stone shaped like a giant blacksmith's anvil. I was trying to rock the stone up so I could get the key that was underneath. It wouldn't budge, it was just too damned big. And in the background, but getting closer, I could hear the baying of bloodhounds. Which leads us, I guess, to the subject of jailbreaks. Sure, they happen from time to time in our happy little family. You don't go over the wall, though, not at Shawshank, not if you're smart. The searchlight beams go all night, probing long white fingers across the open fields that surround the prison on three sides and the stinking marshland on the fourth. Cons do go over the wall from time to time, and the searchlights almost always catch them. If not, they get picked up trying to thumb a ride on Highway 6 or Highway 99. If they try to cut across country, some farmer sees them and just phones the location into the prison. Cons who go over the wall are stupid cons. Shawshank is no Cannon City, but in a rural area, a man humping his ass across country in a gray pajama suit sticks out like a cockroach on a wedding cake. Over the years, the guys who have done the best, maybe oddly, maybe not so oddly, are the guys who did it on the spur of the moment. Some of them have gone out in the middle of a cart full of sheets. A convict sandwich on white, you could say. There was a lot of that when I first came in here, but over the years they have more or less closed that loophole. Warden Norton's famous Inside Out program produced its share of escapees, too. They were the guys who decided they liked what lay to the right of the hyphen better than what lay to the left. And again, in most cases, it was a very casual kind of thing. Drop your blueberry rake and stroll into the bushes while one of the screws is having a glass of water at the truck, or when a couple of them get too involved in arguing over yards passing or rushing on the old Boston Patriots. In 1969, the inside-outers were picking potatoes in Sabattis. It was the 3rd of November, and the work was almost done. There was a guard named Henry Pugh, and he is no longer a member of our happy little family, believe me, sitting on the back bumper of one of the potato trucks and having his lunch with his carbine across his knees, when a beautiful, or so it was told to me, but sometimes these things get exaggerated, 10-point buck strolled out of the cold, early afternoon mist. Pugh went after it with visions of just how that trophy would look mounted in his rec room, and while he was doing it, three of his charges just walked away. Two were recaptured in a Lisbon Falls pinball parlor. The third has not been found to this day. I suppose the most famous case of all was that of Sid Nadeau. This goes back to 1958, and I guess it will never be topped. Sid was out lining the ball field for a Saturday intramural baseball game when the 3 o'clock inside whistle blew, signaling the shift change for the guards. The parking lot is just beyond the exercise yard, on the other side of the electrically operated main gate. At 3, the gate opens, and the guards coming on duty and those going off mingle. There's a lot of back-slapping and bully-ragging, comparison of league bowling scores, and the usual number of tired old ethnic jokes. Sid just trundled his lining machine right out through the gate, leaving a 3-inch baseline all the way from home plate in the exercise yard to the ditch on the far side of Route 6, where they found the machine overturned in a pile of lime. Don't ask me how he did it. He was dressed in his prison uniform, he stood 6'2", and he was billowing clouds of lime dust behind him. All I can figure is that, it being Friday afternoon and all, the guards going off were so happy to be going off, and the guards coming in were so down-hearted to be coming in, that the members of the former group never got their heads out of the clouds, and those in the latter never got their noses off their shoe tops. And old Sid Nadeau just sort of slipped out between the two. So far as I know, Sid is still at large. Over the years, Andy Dufresne and I had a good many laughs over Sid Nadeau's great escape, and when we heard about that airline hijacking for ransom, the one where the guy parachuted from the back door of the airplane, Andy swore up and down that D.B. Cooper's real name was Sid Nadeau. And he probably had a pocket full of baseline lime in his pocket for good luck, Andy said, that lucky son of a bitch. But you should understand that a case like Sid Nadeau, or the fellow who got clean away from the Sabattis potato field crew, guys like that are winning the prison version of the Irish sweepstakes. Purely a case of six different kinds of luck somehow gelling together all at the same moment. A stiff like Andy could wait 90 years and not get a similar break. Maybe you remember, a ways back I mentioned a guy named Henley Backus, the washroom foreman in the laundry. He came to Shawshank in 1922 and died in the prison infirmary 31 years later. Escapes and escape attempts were a hobby of his, maybe because he never quite dared to take the plunge himself. He could tell you 100 different schemes, all of them crackpot, and all of them had been tried in the shank at one time or another. My favorite was the tale of Beaver Morrison, a B&E convict who tried to build a glider from scratch in the plate factory basement. The plans he was working from were in a circa 1900 book called The Modern Boy's Guide to Fun and Adventure. Beaver got it built without being discovered, or so the story goes, only to discover there was no door from the basement big enough to get the damn thing out. When Henley told that story, you could bust a gut laughing, and he knew a dozen, no, two dozen, almost as funny. When it came to detailing Shawshank bust-outs, Henley had it down, chapter and verse. He told me once that during his time there had been better than 400 escape attempts that he knew of. Really think about that for a moment before you just nod your head and pass on. 400 escape attempts. That comes out to 12.9 escape attempts for every year Henley Backus was in Shawshank and keeping track of them. The Escape Attempt of the Month Club. Of course, most of them were pretty slipshod affairs, the sort of thing that ends up with a guard grabbing some poor sidling slob's arm and growling, "Where do you think you're going, you happy asshole?" Henley said he'd class maybe 60 of them as more serious attempts, and he included the prison break of 1937, the year before I arrived at the shank. The new administration wing was under construction then, and 14 cons got out using construction equipment in a poorly locked shed. The whole of southern Maine got into a panic over those 14 hardened criminals, most of whom were scared to death and had no more idea of where they should go than a jackrabbit does when its headlight pinned to the highway with a big truck bearing down on it. Not one of those 14 got away. Two of them were shot dead, by civilians, not police officers or prison personnel. But none got away. How many had gotten away between 1938, when I came here, and that day in October when Andy first mentioned Zihuatanejo to me? Putting my information and Henley's together, I'd say 10. 10 that got away clean. And although it isn't the kind of thing you can know for sure, I'd guess that at least half of those 10 are doing time in other institutions of lower learning, like the shank. Because you do get institutionalized. When you take away a man's freedom and teach him to live in a cell, he seems to lose his ability to think in dimensions. He's like that jackrabbit I mentioned, frozen in the oncoming lights of the truck that is bound to kill it. More often than not, a con who's just out will pull some dumb job that hasn't a chance in hell of succeeding. And why? Because it'll get him back inside, back where he understands how things work. Andy wasn't that way, but I was. The idea of seeing the Pacific sounded good, but I was afraid that actually being there would scare me to death. The bigness of it.